Hi, this is Emma Sutherland. Join us on FX Medicine next week, where I'll be talking to Dr. Douglas Jones about the treatment of food allergies. Subscribe to us on your favourite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode. Hi, and welcome to FX Medicine, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. FX Medicine acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. With us today is naturopath Dr. Leah Heckman, a name many of you will recognise as a powerhouse of knowledge within the natural health sector. Leah specialises in fertility, pregnancy and reproductive health for men and women. She's also a university lecturer, keynote speaker, author, educator, as well as mentor to her peers. She completed her PhD through the School of Women's and Children's Health at the University of New South Wales and is the author of Clinical Naturopathic Medicine and Advanced Clinical Natural Medicine. Today, we're going to deep dive into the complexities of andropause in our older male patients and improve our understanding of the neuroendocrinology of testosterone and how to clinically approach andropause. Welcome to FX Medicine, Leah. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Now, I'm really interested in this topic because over the last 12 months, I've had more and more men that see me asking for sort of preventative support in this space of male hormones. And I feel I need to upskill and really learn how to support my male patients better than what I'm doing currently. And I wanted to pick your brain on all aspects of andropause, or actually, is it andropause? Maybe let's start with the terminology so we can set the slate really clear on what we're talking about today. What is the official definition? Is it andropause? I mean, I found many conflicting definitions, to be honest.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's a great place to start because I quite like the word andropause. I think someone hears it, particularly someone that's in, you know, a medical field, they know what we're talking about. You know, they correlate it with female menopause. They know that it obviously means a decline in hormone production and subsequent flow-on effects. So I think it's a good name. It's just that in the literature at the moment, they sort of argue about it. You know, they go, oh, no, andropause is rubbish. It doesn't exist. You know, we shouldn't talk about it like that. And we should only talk about this tiny subset of the male population who have what they lovingly call late onset hypergonadism, you know, so that is that their gonads are underfunctioning and it's later in life, which is, you know, like when we create these complicated medical names for something simple. Mm. I'm just not sure that we need to go that far. But I also think the challenge of that name, late onset hypergonadism, suggests that it doesn't happen to all men, which we know is not the case. I mean, we know that all men will have an aging process and a subsequent decline in their androgen production, but equally a decline in all sorts of, you know, biological aging processes.
Exactly. But, you know, what is the actual definition of this situation? What does it mean exactly?
Technically, they're talking about testosterone levels.
Yeah.
So technically, they're suggesting that total testosterone and free testosterone and SHBG will have declining numbers. The arguments around what that number is, you know, country to country and association to association. In Australia, for example, you know, less than 10 for a total testosterone is indicative of underfunctioning testosterone production, so low androgens. But country to country, there's some specificities there. But I mean, fundamentally, it's, are you looking at this concept of andropause, which is much more holistic and incorporates the aging process, or are you just looking at low testosterone? And I think, you know, like with women, you know, for so long they looked at menopause and said, it's just low estrogen. I think we need to be having the conversation about men and go, it's not just low testosterone, you know. So I think we need to start talking about the intricacies of it, which is why I think our chat's really good. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I think technically late onset hypogonadism is the term, but then the concept of andropause broadens that reach to incorporate everything that happens as men age. But can you talk us through testosterone production and then how aging impacts this?
This is where it gets really fun. Fun for me because I'm a research geek. So there's some new papers that have been coming out lately, and we're starting to develop a few theories that I think are really quite interesting. So I think where we're at with men and male reproductive function, and no disrespect to men, it's just looking at it from a medical research perspective, our understanding of male fertility is sort of about 20 years behind women because it was always around male fertility that if you produce sperm, you were fertile. We didn't look any further. Now we realize that there's all these other endocrinological processes, there's, you know, mechanisms of sperm production, hormone production, et cetera, and we're starting to understand the intricacies with it. And there's a couple of papers that have come out in, let's say, the last 2 years that specifically are looking at this. And one group headed by, I think the name is Nie, N-I-E, in 22, and I'll give you some details of some of these papers. And they're starting to talk about the concept of the testicular niche and the differentiation between the function of Sertoli cells versus Leydig cells. So Sertoli cells within the testes are what produce sperm, and Leydig cells are what produce testosterone. And what they're finding as they're diving into the research and they're looking at it and correlating age and, you know, reduction of testosterone production and all these sorts of things, is that they're realizing that actually Leydig cell number is actually declining, not testosterone production. And so now we're starting to realize that Leydig cells are probably more similar to female oocytes in the sense that the oocyte number declines, the Leydig cell number declines. And so that's why the production of hormones actually declines, rather than that they have an inability to produce the hormone itself.
Okay, so is there a reduction in the function of the Leydig cells or the number?
No, just
only?
Number. But bear in mind that that's 2024. And we might find in 5 years, 10 years' time that we actually start to understand Leydig cells even more intricately, and we start to actually look at their production similarly to an oocyte production, and we start to see cellular changes. But no one's been that interested in it, if we're really frank. So now they're getting really interested in, and they're looking at age-related dysregulation of the process. So it started as an interest in, well, why are men having lower sperm counts as they're getting older? And now they're realizing, well, there's a Sertoli piece and there's actually a Leydig piece, and what is happening in the testy itself. So functionally, the testy is aging. And so within that, the cells are changing.
Okay. This is,
does that make sense?
It does. It's actually really fascinating. And I'm also wondering around the age-related changes from a vascular perspective.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, the vascular stuff, I think we've got some really beautiful information out there in the context of older male erectile dysfunction. Everyone's seeing the, you know, the flag for that, indicating look at vascular and cardiovascular health, But when we're looking at the aging process, the male aging process is fascinating because the way the male body ages is very different to the female aging process in some ways. The vascular system almost becomes like the roadmap of how every single system, every single cell in the body starts aging. And it starts with the vascular decline. And you can usually pick it in men even in their late teens if they're going to be a candidate for vascular dysfunction and the severity of it based on a whole host of different things. But you start to see warning signs quite early, and really important to pick it up in men.
And what kind of warning signs are you talking about?
Sexual dysfunction signs, definitely. But even, you know, things like Raynaud's, migraines, headaches, poor vascular tone, poor cardiovascular fitness, using things like HRV tracking to look at heart recovery in the variability within a 24-hour time period, looking at all of the endocrinology that influences the vascular system. Mm-hmm. So whether or not there's a high BMI, whether or not they're metabolically unhealthy, whether or not there's a lot of visceral fat, whether or not they don't sleep enough and they do too much shift work, like all of those other hormone bits affect the vascular system in men so dramatically. I think we've underestimated it for a really long time.
Yeah. And I know we're going to dive into some of those things and dig a bit deeper. On the surface level, you know, when you're looking at the research and you're looking at this andropause picture, you get all the classic symptoms like low energy, depression, you know, difficulty losing weight, low motivation, low libido, erectile dysfunction. Any other sort of white flags that you would pick up on? Let's say a 50-year-old, 40, 50-year-old.
I think it's important that we're honest and we really look at aesthetic aspects, not from an aesthetic interpretation, but more from how early are they, is their hair graying?
Oh, yeah.
How quickly are they losing collagen? How quickly is their, you know, hip to waist ratio changing and that abdominal adiposity changing? Men have, you know, quite distinct skin changes really early. The eye colour changes really early. But the brain stuff is just remarkable, both from a cognitive, memory, sleep, emotional, psychological aspect. I mean, anxiety peaks in 50-year-old men.
Yes.
Sense of purpose, sense of, you know, like the ability to have dopamine surges changes. It's so rapid and so subtle at the beginning. And you just find these 50-year-old men and they're kind of like, oh, this is just aging.
Yes.
And they just sort of accept it. Some men, it's really fascinating. But they're aware that they're just not as, you know, one of my patients said to me, I'm not as powerful as I used to be. And I went, yeah, that's testosterone for you.
Yes, that's one word that really sums it up, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Are there any biomarkers that you look at to assess for andropause? And if so, what are they? How do you use them?
I'm a big advocate of hormone testing in all delivery systems. For my men, I do Dutch analyses on them so that I can understand their conversion of their hormones, particularly how they're converting their estrogens and they're metabolizing it, like all that sort of aspect. But, you know, a Dutch helps you understand what the testosterone is doing, you know, DHT levels. Is it actually getting some testosterone from DHEA? Is there a cortisol imbalance, melatonin production? Like, it gives you that thorough overview of the endocrinology, and then I do the saliva and the urine from a Dutch in combination with bloods.
Okay.
I'm a big advocate with men, and I certainly have conversations about this with a lot of people, but I always test progesterone. I always test estrogen. I'll always test FSH and LH. I really want to understand the full picture of the endocrinology of a male. And you can often spot early, if we call it andropause, early andropause with declining progesterone levels or absent progesterone levels.
Okay.
And I think that a lot of clinicians have been quite centric around testosterone and haven't really been expansive and thorough in looking at all the aspects. And then, as I always refer to it with endocrinology, you know, the domino effect, really go deep into all the endocrinological pathways with detail, you know, so really looking at their metabolic markers, including things like leptin and ghrelin and insulin and HOMA and IGF-1 to get a growth hormone interpretation, like going everywhere to get a full sense, because you see a decline across the board before that testosterone does its big dive.
Okay.
And really make sure that you're looking at it completely. And that's just the endocrinology part.
Yeah, exactly. That's one aspect. For those blood hormones, when do you test them? Because I've read a lot of research around the diurnal rhythms of these hormones. So when is the best time to have them tested?
I think it depends on what you're trying to look at. And that's where I find that having the Dutch, because there's multiple times in the day, it gives me more confidence around the 24-hour window. And then if I see, like some men, what I've done is I've done the Dutch with the melatonin and the cortisol first to get a sense of what patterns happen in their body and match that with their sleep rhythms. And then I'll do their bloods accordingly. Like if I see that they're a flatline cortisol all day, it probably doesn't matter when I test their testosterone.
Okay.
But if there's, you know, peaks and troughs, then it will influence it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So as always, it's individualized, but it's a good kind of insight.
But usually the consensus is to try to do it first thing in the morning for everybody.
Right. Okay.
If you've got no other parameter. Yeah.
Okay. Beautiful. And then I'm curious around what the actual situation with infertility rates are and aging versus the story that the media is telling us about this rapid global decline in sperm counts. I mean, what do you think is going on here?
I'm trying to work out which way we go. So I think there's a couple of different things here. Okay. Yeah. So one of the biggest things that I sort of always highlight, you know, this whole idea of sperm counts are declining. When you actually take a step back and you have a look at the World Health Organization guidelines and you look at the last five editions, there's been quite a distinct difference in interpretation. So our analysis of what is a reference range about sperm parameters is governed by this World Health Organization guideline. And if you factor in that, for example, you know, the second edition was still using the hamster egg test, which was literally where they had a sperm and could it penetrate a hamster egg.
Right.
So we're looking at, you know, distinct differences in andrology testing, in equipment, in collection guidelines, in interpretation, in technological advances, et cetera.
Mm.
When you factor all of that in and you acknowledge that there's been a distinct difference, there's definitely a decline.
Okay.
So it may not be as dramatic as human reproduction was trying to talk to us about between 2017 and 2022. And those papers were sort of looking at, the 2017 paper was looking at between 1973 and 2011. So it's like just a huge period of time, but recognize that they had four editions of the WHO guidelines in there. Yeah. But that was talking about a 60% decline. And then when you got to 2017 and they did a meta-analysis and then looked at the next few years, then they felt that there was still an overall decline of 62%. So what I would say is, yes, there's a decline. How much the decline is, I think it's tricky to interpret country to country in addition to addition, but it's pretty bad.
Okay.
That's the summation. Is it doom and gloom? No. But is it pretty bad? Yes.
Okay, so we really need to do what we can with our patients to turn this around, which is around optimizing their hormonal health. I'm curious.
Absolutely.
I'm curious, Leah, because it really starts in the brain. So, if possible, can you talk us through what happens in the brain during this andropause period in a man?
So we basically need to get a Lisa Moscone for men now.
Yeah, we do.
Lisa Moscone did all the mapping for women. We need a male one, and we don't have that data yet.
Okay.
So let's – I'm being really transparent and honest here.
Yeah.
So we've got parts of data, but we don't have, you know, year tracking the way that she's done it with women now, which helps us see the shape changes really, really clearly and beautifully. We have fragments of information, okay? So with the fragments of information, we know that the male brain is dramatically different to women. We can't look at women data.
Yeah.
We know that the shape of it changes and it does shrink. We know that certain sections of it in particular are shown to shrink, which correlate with memory specifically and which correlate with spatial ability and spatial awareness and the ability to problem solve and those sorts of things. And when you look at the classic brain aging data that doesn't include Lisa's work, it was all about everyone as they age, their brain changes like that. But now we understand that that's actually very male-centric, and the male-centric perspective is unless you use it, you lose it, of course. But in addition to that, you know, you've got all the changes in the brain that correlate with emotionality. And so most men do find that they can't get the same highs that they used to get, because testosterone really drives dopamine, for example.
Okay.
They don't get the reward fix. So they don't get the joys and the sense of joie de vivre as much, or the sense of like completing that powerful weather that patient said, you know.
Yeah.
Like they don't get that feeling, and the brain changes are indicative of that. Like the receptors are completely different with progesterone and testosterone for them.
Yeah. Okay. There's just a plethora, isn't there? There's just such a plethora of questions in this space. But, you know, from my understanding, testosterone is a neurosteroid. You know, it's you know, the nervous system is both a source of and a target for testosterone. So I feel like this bidirectional relationship makes sense to me, but also helps me then explain to patients how the changes are not just, you know, erectile issues. You know, these is whole systemic changes that happen here.
Yeah. And I think it's remembering how many receptors for each of these hormones are around our body. You know, like every single part of your body will have a different response to it. Like it might be as simple as getting Raynaud's in your fingertips. Do you know what I mean? And that's because the testosterone is not getting all the way there. And then equally it might be around just having really depressed mood. I think it's important that we really have this conversation, particularly around mood with men. And I'm sure, you know, there's so many variables that influence it. But the amount of men that are really struggling emotionally, and is this correlating to an aging pathway or is this correlating to the decline in testosterone? Yes. Is it also multifactorial? Absolutely. But we can't underestimate that DHEA, for example, is one of the major hormones in the neuroplasticity of the brain. Progesterone is one of the major hormones in the neuroplasticity of the brain. So the ability of the brain to recover itself, to rewire itself, to grow, depends on having these hormones there. It's a tough one.
Yeah, it is a really tough one. And I was reading around the role of autophagy, aging, and male reproductive disorders, and I found that concept of, you know, how myelination changes as males age really fascinating. But can you just sort of tease that apart and explain that a bit more?
Which bit exactly, the myelination or the autophagy piece?
The autophagy and how it impacts the brain and the changes within the brain.
Look, David Sinclair is remarkable, I mean, his institute now, he's sort of almost getting pushed to the, is this actually achievable? But he's showing that it is. And I think that the longevity movement and the anti-aging movement is teaching us an enormous amount. And it's one of those situations where some of it feels really like, whoa, no, this is just make-believe. But I think we really need to jump on the bandwagon because it's happening now. And so if you think about the Gen X population, so that's the people that are predominantly being affected by this conversation, I think women are really jumping on board it really intently, and they're transforming menopause in such a beautiful way. And I think that men need to take this, because the autophagy aspect is essentially that we have the capacity to basically delay aging or reverse it through supplementation, through various practices and strategies and different things that we can do. And the women are taking it on board, and some men are, but I don't think enough are. And I think that more men need to really embrace it. And this is why all of those natural, easy autophagy strategies that we implement or recommend, from cold water therapy to saunas to infrared, or to amazing things like nicotinamide riboside or any of those NAD precursors or spermidine or any of those things that affect the SIRT2 pathways. The pathways are really well understood. We've got lots of mouse data around it. We've got early human data about it, but we are showing that the autophagy capacity of rewiring the brain is there. The remyelination of the nerves is there. The capacity to repair various structures in the body, including the heart, the data is there. And the autophagy perspective is really just, I think that we really need to really keep looking at it and challenging ourselves and go, okay, let's look at the fasting data. Is it actually real that men should only be eating one meal a day? Should they really be reducing their total caloric intake to actually assist in that autophagy process? And when you look at the data specifically with men, because they don't have the hormonal fluctuations of women in menstruating years, let's say, they actually do better. And they are younger, and their biological age does improve. And then you look at like the glycan age information, which is looking at all those glycans around inflammation and aging and whatever. And men that fast, men that exercise, men that cold water therapy, men that all those things, they're younger and their cells are younger, so they repair better. So it's, it's one of those ones where it's such a big topic.
It is.
I'm happy to go anywhere that you want to go with it, but the evidence is there.
Yeah, my brain is buzzing. Great. I'm just thinking about clinically, you know, this is when you're working with a couple and, you know, trying to get them healthy and maybe lose a little bit of weight from a preconception perspective. And after 6 weeks, the man bounces back in saying he's lost 5 kilos, and the lady's like, I've lost one, and it's really disheartening. And, you know, what you explained really just helps us understand how that actually happens. There's so many things that we have in our toolkit in relation to our patients. I wanted to look at obesity. So there's some really interesting research around the weight testosterone axis. And, you know, I've looked up the latest research that I could find. Technically, around 66% of the Australian population, adult population, are overweight or have a BMI over 25. And there does appear in the research to be this bidirectional relationship between BMI and testosterone.
Yep.
So what mechanisms are driving that weight testosterone axis?
Some of it's going to correlate with insulin and leptin and ghrelin. Some of it's going to correlate with the testosterone decline and the estrogen balance. And like progesterone opposes estrogen in women, testosterone opposes estrogen in men. And so needing to have enough testosterone to not become too estrogenic. But it's interesting because when you actually sort of dive into the data, this is where my brain is mapping it at the moment and hasn't quite nailed it. But so estrogen in women helps to regulate blood sugar levels, but too much estrogen in men actually dysregulates blood sugar levels. So it's, there's like such a difference because of the amount of receptors and because of testosterone for them. So it's the decline in testosterone is also because testosterone keeps our muscles metabolically active, which keeps our sugars balanced, which keeps our weight in check. And then when that starts to decline, weight goes up. But then when weight is up, it suppresses testosterone. So it's a tricky balance. But it fundamentally, for men primarily, the primary drivers, like at the heart of it, is all around insulin and leptin and sleep. And sleep seems to affect men even more strongly than women in some of the data that I've seen, which I found really interesting and positive and negative. But I don't know if it's because the data is skewed in the sense that more men do shift work typically. But then you look at nurses and you go, really, is that true? I don't know. But the data that I kept reading was suggesting that. But, yeah, it's – I sort of think that – distribution of weight has a big influence to hormone cascades, so because men are also carrying it predominantly in their abdomen, it's affecting it so much more in that correlation.
And that whole Goldilocks principle around estrogen, you know, not enough isn't good, too much isn't good, that balance of estrogen and the balance of testosterone is just so critical. But I feel like this picture around insulin, which I see in a lot of women in perimenopause as well, and menopause, I feel like that insulin picture is such a big driver from a weight perspective, and the sensitivity of the glucose uptake in the muscles themselves seems to be quite impaired at this point because of the hormone dysfunction.
Definitely.
When you were talking about sleep, I think I read some research around sleep loss and lower sleep duration associated with lower testosterone levels.
Yes.
If that is a ongoing situation, like you, you know, a shift worker, as you mentioned, what is the outcome of that over time?
The outcome of shift work or the outcome of poor sleep quality or?
Yeah, either or on hormonal health. Yeah, because we have a, I mean, I have a lot of patients that work odd hours, a lot of my male patients, and I'm wondering whether I need to almost flag them in my mind for doing some testing a little bit earlier than I would for a man who is doing a 9-to-5 office job, for example.
I don't think I've ever seen a paper, and certainly I haven't seen it in clinic either, that associates sleep loss with any health gain.
Yeah,
and we know that people, I remember reading one paper, people that sleep less than 6 hours per day accelerate their aging by 40%.
Whoa.
And their time to death is closer. So essentially you're making your body die faster by not sleeping enough. Some research thinks that men can survive on less sleep than women, but technically they shouldn't. Because their vascular changes get more pronounced faster because they don't have enough lymphatic clearance of the brain. They don't have enough, you know, REM cycles to process things, that sort of stuff. But their repair just doesn't happen. But men as they age, they have a natural aging process on the HPT axis, so the hypothalamic pituitary testicular axis. And so they think that the sleep is one of the main drivers of that Leydig cell loss.
Okay.
So then the cycle keeps going round, but they actually think that the HPT axis shrinks the testes and shrinks the brain. So the lack of sleep comes in, the pineal gland gets changed, the melatonin production gets declined, and then that sort of starts the cascade of events. But they're actually correlating the sleep loss to probably the biggest driver. So sugar and sleep, as I was saying before, sugar and sleep seem to be the biggest game changers for men. And I think that it's, I mean, definitely a conversation we have to have with everybody, but definitely with men, because they seem to be able to tolerate it differently. And I try to get men to use wearables quite early, because a lot of men don't realize that they're not actually getting enough deep sleep.
Yeah.
So they're not actually getting the repair. But it's like that whole HPT axis gets thrown without enough sleep really quickly. And then the cascades, it's so rapid for them.
Mm. And just on that deep sleep, are you aiming for around 20% deep sleep or more or less?
It sort of depends. Let me just think. It's usually around cycles and duration, yeah. And you're wanting to try to get as much deep as you're getting REM, or ideally a bit more REM than deep. But it just depends on duration of what they're getting. But they say that the aging decline happens when a person gets less than an hour of deep sleep per sleep duration period,
yeah,
and that they can't sort of catch it up.
Yeah, okay, beautiful. Because I love wearables, and men are often tend to be data focused, and it speaks their language. So really great tool for us.
Fantastic.
Leah, what about stress and the impact of stress on testosterone levels and andropause in general?
So stress is not good for anyone. If we sort of think about, you know, too much stress. Yeah, it's about the basics of steroidogenesis, and that if their cortisol production is too significant, then testosterone production goes down naturally. Yes. It's about that too much cortisol production also makes a decline in DHEA, which then has a rebound effect on glutathione and a rebound effect on melatonin. So like everything starts crashing from it. But the thing with stress is the impact in the whole cycle of it. Yeah. So too much stress makes them sleep poorly, makes their recovery poor, makes their brain shrink, then makes their insulin go up, then makes their sugar, you know, like they go round and round in circles. But stress and testosterone are never a good combination unless it's self-directed stress. So if it's intentional exercise stress or temperature stress, that is shown to be positive for men and testosterone. Mm-hmm. So one of the quickest ways to get testosterone up is to tell a man to have a cold shower. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a cold shower and a positive stress is good, but a negative stress is always going to have a ripple effect. And the first thing with men is testosterone and insulin and sleep. They're just the three that always go.
Yeah. Okay. And obviously starting that really vicious cycle that self-perpetuates from there.
Completely.
Now, what about, what else can I pick your brains on? Prostate cancer. Now, this is an interesting one because a lot of men have some degree of prostate cancer, but they don't always die from it. So give us some insights here around andropause and prostate cancer and hormones here.
I think with prostate cancer, it's a tricky one. I mean, I think we underestimate the importance of the prostate. So let's start with that.
Yeah.
We underestimate the importance of the prostate for longevity, for orgasm, for endorphins and enkephalin release, for seminal fluid production. Mm-hmm. We underestimate the prostate's inflammatory impact, obviously, on the urinary system. But the prostate, you know, from a functional perspective, is so restorative to the male body.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be a magnet, obviously from a cancer cell perspective, but it seems to be a magnet for hormonal dysfunction, inflammation and inflammaging, so that aging inflammation cycle. And it disrupts so many of the other qualities. And so there were a few papers that I saw actually that sort of talk about even just prostatitis, where there's inflammation of the prostate, not just prostate cancer, and just the swelling of the environment and its impact to the Leydig cell function and to the Sertoli cell function. And so because of the close proximity and because of just the functional nature of it all, and just how that's actually causing an inflammatory process affecting the hormone production that way. But the incidence of it, if there's inflammation there and it's suppressing testosterone, then all those estrogens are more impactful. Then all of the other endocrinology becomes more impactful. And the prostate itself is a bit of a magnet for environmental exposure. So the testes are definitely, you know, a magnet for that sort of perspective as well. But the prostate, because of what the prostate tissue is made of, it seems to absorb a whole host of byproducts, toxin runoff, eliminatory stuff that should come through semen or should come through urine seems to go and be magnetized to the prostate. And heavy metals love the prostate.
Yeah.
So there's all these things that will perpetuate the development of prostate cancer. And then the last piece is obviously around the microbiome and infection, because, you know, undiagnosed prostate infections, undiagnosed testicular infections, or infections in any of the apparatus around that area, like low-grade chronic infection, does cause that inflammatory process and does cause a microbial change in the prostate, and then the prostate fluid, which then will be driving an infective prostate cancer.
Right.
So there's so many pathways with it. But again, I go back to what we sort of said at the very beginning, which is I think we need to understand the male body a lot more.
Yeah.
I think we underestimate the importance of all of these different parts of the body. And like I always speak to any males that I work with that sadly have to have their prostate removed, and we talk about what they're losing by removing the prostate and how they can gain that in other areas of their life. But most men, when they lose their prostate, their dopamine levels just crash and their depression goes up, and they just feel so, sorry for the use of the word, but they feel so impotent, just, you know, in all aspects of their life. And yeah, I think we really need to look at it a little bit more closely, just how important it is for men.
Yeah. And we really know so little in this space, but we've got to dig on what we do know, and I feel like this is really interesting. I read one study when researching for this on phthalates that showed a lower level of free testosterone in factory workers at a flooring company compared to age match controls in the construction industry. And just that one little snippet alone made me think, wow, we've got a lot of work to do in so many facets with male health.
So many.
What about erectile dysfunction? This one I feel like is the poster symptom for androgen issues, but it's not quite as simple as it seems because it's so multifactorial. We know that men that have erectile dysfunction, it's like this white flag for further issues. But if a man comes in to see you and he is telling you that there are issues with erectile dysfunction, what are the sort of things that you would advise him, or how would you test for this if you were testing? I presume you just do the Dutch or your usual testing you've mentioned, but is there anything specific you would do in this space? Because it's a very sensitive area as well.
Yeah, of course. I think the first thing that you have to have the conversation around with erectile dysfunction is, are they able to achieve morning erection, or is it performance based?
Yeah.
And delineate between, is there a dysfunction functionally and or psychologically? Once you delineate between those, I think you get a bit more clarity about the next steps. But assuming that it's a functional one, we can talk about the psychological part after if you want. But the functional part of it, I think it's imperative that they do a sleep study, that they do some blood work around cardiovascular health, that they do a calcium score, that you get a really good sense of their cardiovascular health and their sleep capacity and oxygen uptake and lung function and those sorts of things, because it's usually a pre-diagnostic for something else going on. And it's unfortunate that a lot of men are still just given pharmaceuticals for erectile function and are not considered to be exploring some of those other areas. I don't think I've ever had a male present with functional erectile dysfunction that doesn't have either sleep apnea or something, you know, untoward with their cardiovascular function or some metabolic syndrome of some description. So really important to look at it. And if cholesterol is elevated, you know, to do the lipid fractions and to really understand them, but to do a calcium score to determine, is this actually a problem or is this actually potentially not genetic or what's actually going on? Tidy all of that up and then get a really good sense around just vascular function. And I think this is where functional medicine is just so powerful, because we have agents to help vascular function. So assuming, you know, assuming that we tick all those other boxes, we look at endocrinology and sleep and whatever, you know, we have beautiful herbs like ginkgo, you know, we have grapeseed extract, we have so many beautiful things, vitamin D, bioflavonoids, whatever, that make a tremendous amount of difference because it actually helps to restore the tissue in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much that we can do, but as long as you tick all those other aspects, things are quite powerful. But then, you know, if you think about the psychological part of it, there's a lot that we can do as well, you know, and sometimes the psychology develops from emotional things or traumas, or sometimes it develops because they did have a history of vascular insufficiency or they were overweight for a period of their life and then now believe that they'll never have erectile function. You know, you just got to go digging and work out what's happening.
Yeah. Okay, beautiful. Let's move to treatments. I wanted to have a quick look at testosterone replacement therapy because, you know, that's often what patients are offered. What are the pros and cons of this approach?
So, pros and cons. Let's start with it needs to be properly prescribed through a compound pharmacy or a proprietary product if they want to go that way, and never go on any form of testosterone therapy if you're wanting to preserve your fertility and your sperm production because testosterone therapy suppresses sperm count. But if they are wanting to use testosterone therapy, I think there's some exceptional compound products available. And they certainly do make an enormous amount of difference for people if it's indicated, but important to understand that it is, and important to understand the full endocrinological picture before you just jump to testosterone, because it might be DHEA that they actually need.
Yeah.
And they have great conversion, but it's because they're aging and that's the sort of thing that they need.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of things that we can do to support testosterone from a functional perspective that isn't necessarily a hormone. I mean, I think, you know, the data on zinc is nothing short of astounding.
Yes.
And every time someone comes out with another review about zinc, you go, yes, there's even more benefit here. And I think with zinc, we really need to be conscious around, you know, ceruloplasmin and copper status in men, the importance of copper and also the detriment of copper.
Mm.
And so getting the balance right and understanding, you know, the free and bound copper perspective.
Yeah.
Getting an understanding around iron for them so that we are achieving the optimal zinc, but also, you know, a lot of men present in clinic with undiagnosed hemochromatosis, but also excessive ferritin for a number of different reasons, which is suppressing their zinc uptake as well. So I think to really get that holistic perspective of the triad is important.
Yeah.
And then we've got some beautiful herbs. You know, I'm sure you use, you know, in your clinic, ashwagandha, or you use tribulus, or you use Damiana, or any of the other beautiful herbs that we've got. And they're all fantastic in different ways.
Yes. Yes. We do have a fantastic toolkit on that side of things. Any particular favourites, though? I mean, when I'm looking, I had a good dig into the research on tribulus, for example, and there's varying doses that often depends on the form of tribulus, of course, that's been used in the research, but the doses can range from sort of 250 milligrams three times a day up to 500 milligrams three times a day. But, yeah, any clinical pearls around the use of tribulus?
Tribulus, I find it's dependent on the form. So is it extract or capsule or other? And the quality, obviously, of what you're using. But I find that with some men, they actually do better with tribulus doses at night giving them a reasonably strong dose at night with cortisol supportive types of herbs.
Yeah.
So whether or not that's rhodiola or if it's theanine, for example, or ashwagandha or whatever it might be. Not that theanine's a herb, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The combination of them tends to work really well when you do it that way.
Okay.
But if you're doing a liquid, you can certainly do it through the day, and then it's the synergy effect, you know, and then it's the combination of different herbs and how they work together. And, you know, there's some beautiful Chinese medicine herbs and beautiful Ayurvedic herbs that we don't do, and traditional Ayurvedic practices around preparations of what you put the herbs in and things. So I think it's really looking definitely at the individual, but looking at what that person needs. And is it that the testosterone is depleted because of aging, or depleted because of burnout, or depleted because of excessive weight? And then how you deliver it, I think, is the strategy.
Yeah, and I love that sort of framework around, first of all, let's dig into why those hormone levels have declined or are where they are, rather than just presuming it's one-dimensional and that, for example, tribulus will fix everything.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't, and it's not meant to.
Mm, And when you mentioned before the synergy of herbs, I think sometimes we tend to forget that, you know, when we're looking specifically at research where they are studying one herb, for example, and the impact of that one herb, you know, I don't think any research can effectively assess the synergistic impact of our herbal combinations. From that aspect, I mean, I would love there to be that research capacity one day.
Be interesting to see if they could do it.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so in relation, you did mention before a little around intermittent fasting, but what are your thoughts on this in your clinical experience? What do you see working well? What do you see not working well? Because, you know, from an individualized perspective, some of my patients, male and female, but, you know, they're really burnt out. They're exhausted. Their insulin's all over the place. Their cortisol's all over the place. You know, should these patients be fasting? Should they not be fasting? Any caveats here?
Yeah, for sure. Look, I think every human on the planet can do a 12-12 model, you know, 12 hours where they don't have any food in their body. And I don't think that that's negative or disruptive. I think probably one of the biggest challenges in clinic is that a lot of people will fast for the bulk of the day but then consume the total day's calories in 2 hours. So I think we've got to really be honest about what are we doing here? Are we fasting or are we just shrinking time windows, you know?
Yes.
And I think that when you look at a person that's burnt out and high cortisol or even where they're flatline cortisol, like they're that far gone sort of people, the idea of not eating can sometimes be a restorative process, provided that when they eat, let's say it's a 6-hour window that they eat very well digestible foods, they eat non-stimulatory foods, and it's all about rebuilding and, you know, supporting the body. And when they're in their fasting window, maybe they're drinking electrolytes, they're drinking, you know, herbal teas, things like that. But for some people, they're so depleted that their body has no reserves whatsoever. And then they're going to need to be consuming food throughout the day. Generally with men, though, I find that the quickest way to stabilize their sugars is to get them to fast for a fairly long period. And they positively thrive when they do it. You just can't get them onto the coffee bandwagon where they drink 4 or 5 cups of coffee in the morning and then eat, you know, like 2 million calories at 5 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
That scenario never works for anybody. But it's a really quick way to get digestive tone. It's a really quick way to get blood sugar stability. It's a really quick way for them to start to rest more deeply at night.
Yeah.
Depending on how much exercise they do.
Yes.
So if they're like a really big trainer and they're, you know, doing lots of weights and lots of cardio, they're going to need a lot more food just to do that. And then they're not going to sleep because they're starving. So you just got to work out with each individual. But the 12-12 is, you know, normal healthy eating,
Yes.
For the average person, it just some people sway out of that one.
Yeah, exactly. I think 12-12 is really easy. When you say fast for a longer time frame, what are you talking, a 16-hour, 18 hours?
I've got some men that like 22 hours.
Yeah,
and
right.
They literally only eat for 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
But it just depends on, like, I think it's important to really look at what they're trying to achieve in their day. I don't know that I love 22-hour fasts for anyone. It just depends on their blood sugars and what keeps them stable, because then their blood sugars keep their autophagy working, which keeps their, you know, their metabolic profile really stable. You know, as long as everything is okay and working.
Yeah.
But that's the extreme anti-aging movement, is a 22-hour fast.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
Pros and cons with it.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, one last question that's just popped into my brain now. From a testosterone receptor perspective, any recommendations on how we increase the sensitivity of the receptors to the hormone itself?
Remove the competition is number one.
Okay.
Yeah, so the competition will be environmental pollutants, will be other hormones, particularly insulin, will be, you know, various exposure things that they've had, that you've, even from xenoestrogens and other estrogen-like molecules, phthalates, stuff like that. So reducing the exposure and the competition to other things. But the actual receptor itself, its integrity is governed by vitamin D and zinc particularly. So making sure that that's there, and then improving the communication between the receptor and the hormone molecule is all about the charge. So it all comes back to electrolytes. So the electrolyte regulation of the fluid and how it's picked up And the calcium toolkit concept around the oral side in women, the calcium toolkit concept is still there in men. It just starts to broaden a little bit more differently in, you know, quantities of sodium or potassium mm-hmm. or magnesium for that matter, and manganese, molybdenum becomes really important for men. And it's really all that charge aspect of how everything goes in.
Interesting you say that, because I do use a lot of electrolytes with my patients in clinic, and I constantly get surprised at the quite quick but subtle changes that happen when people take electrolytes consistently.
Absolutely. What are you noticing?
I'm noticing mental clarity. I'm noticing a cellular energy. It's almost like a mitochondrial increase. But when I'm not giving CoQ10 or any other things that are actually specifically supporting mitochondrial function. And interestingly, a decrease in pain. So decrease in headaches, decrease in, generalized pain in patients. So subtle, but when I do the questioning that we as health practitioners do, you know, we dig into the nitty gritty, there are changes there.
Yeah, definitely. Electrolytes are amazing. I think we all need to stay abreast of sodium, in the sense that it's gotten such a bad rap for so long, and really get more of an understanding of how much we actually need and how important it is, and the combination of electrolytes, because I think as clinicians we've gotten very focused on individual electrolytes at certain points. Everyone's on magnesium, but we're not acknowledging potassium or every, you know what I mean? And so the combination is really where it's remarkable.
Yes, as usual, balance is everything.
Balance, always.
Leah, thank you so much for joining us today. Is there any last minute things in this emerging world of male health that we need to be aware of?
I think a couple of other things I think we just to remind ourselves is the male aging process is dynamic and it's multifactorial. And just because of the hormone part of it, we can't underestimate the decline in all the systems of the body. So, you know, we have to factor in bone health. We have to factor in immunological health. We have to factor in neurological health. Like, all of the different systems are declining as this process is unraveling. But there's so much that we can do. And stabilizing the hormone aspect is youthifying, you know, like it is regenerative, it is restorative. But all of those, you know, we really need to come up with a men's health toolkit, where men get a health check on a yearly basis and they're getting their yearly bone densities and their yearly, you know, heart checks. And like, they really need to be on top of it, because there's so much that can be done to improve the parameters. And this aging process starts young, you know. So even though we're all led to believe that men can make babies, you know, well into their 90s if they want, well, the quality of those babies may not be so great, but we know that male fertility declines from 40. So we know that that means that he's aging from 40, and we know that we really should step up and support him.
Beautiful. All right. A great reminder to zoom out and look at that holistic framework that we are generally really good at, but can tend to forget when we deep dive in things.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Leah. It's been an absolute delight. My brain is literally turned inside out. I don't know. It's like scrambled spaghetti. I need to take some time to just mull everything over and get it in a sequence in my brain.
Beautiful. But thank you for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget, you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine website. I'm Emma Sutherland. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.